The Lord be with you.
And also.
There are three things I want to say before I get into the substance of this seminar. The first is, as has been alluded to, that this issue of child abuse is a highly emotive and probably one of the most difficult and yet the most important issues which I've addressed. This is only the second time which I've spoken about this in public. The last time was for under 3 minutes. And because of the response to that, I felt that the issue perhaps required or was deserving of a larger airing. I don't speak out of the experience of ever having been abused, nor ever having been a perpetrator. But I have, in the past while, been in contact with professionals who deal with people who have been abused and who deal with perpetrators, and have been able to enter into correspondence with people who have known that potential in them and who have abused children. So I don't have a personal axe to grind, and I can say that honestly before God. The second thing is that I expect, to some extent, to be misunderstood. I expect that by the time I've finished, some people will feel that I'm trying to defend the indefensible. This is far from my intention. But I know, having spoken to dozens of people casually about this subject, that merely to mention it is to raise in the minds of people either fears or memories which dominate anything else that's said thereafter. And all they can remember is that which they or someone else whom they love suffered. And the third thing to say is that at the end of this, I'm not going to take any questions. It's taken me a long time to feel for how to approach this in a responsible fashion. And I think given the nature of it, it's perfectly possible for someone to wish to ask a question which perhaps in retrospect would reveal more of themselves than they would like to reveal. And I don't want to compromise anyone here. But if there are issues raised here, particularly as to how this affects people of faith or how the church responds, then tonight between about 10 past 8 and 9 o'clock in the Northern Lights tent, which is a much smaller venue diagonally across Northern Lights, then I'm very happy there to have a conversation with people in a much smaller and more relaxed gathering. That's at 8:05. So here's my starting point. Occasionally, I'm asked to present Thought for the Day on Radio 4. And the expectation is that presenters will take a current issue in the news and reflect on it from their own particular religious standpoint. In the middle of March of this year, one of the current issues was a letter from the Pope to the Roman Catholic Church in Ireland. It came in the wake of a fairly damning report by the Irish government which indicted the church for failing to deal properly with the victims and the abusers in what was a very large child abuse scandal. It happened that a week or so before then, I had been in Southern Ireland and had spoken to a priest who, when he was a curate, had spoken to the bishop about his senior clergyman who he knew was having improper relations with children. The bishop at that time told the young curate to keep his mouth shut, did nothing about the senior priest, but removed the young curate to a different parish. So I decided to deal with this issue and to present this script, which I'll read in full, under 3 minutes. Just a glance at the Pope's pastoral letter to the church in Ireland is enough to confirm that it is lengthy, inclusive, and detailed. An exceptional document, as several commentators have indicated. I think that if I were a priest in that church, I'd go down on my knees before my congregation and ask for forgiveness, and that not out of personal guilt. When an institution, through its silence, seems to condone child abuse, then all in leadership, including the innocent, have a share in responsibility. Given the control which the church in Ireland has long held over education, the degree of potential contact between aberrant priests and innocent children has been considerable. However, it would be wrong to think that child abuse was a phenomenon specific to religious institutions. Years after I left employment in childcare for a London borough, I returned to my previous workplace and inquired after former colleagues who had worked in other children's homes. I was astounded to discover that some of them, who seemed the most decent of men, were serving time for abusing children in their care. If child abuse is a phenomenon which won't go away, then it is right that those in close contact with children should be screened. But screening does not eradicate desire, and it's the desire or temptation to abuse children which needs more attention. We have signs in public places telling people what to do if they suspect they have a propensity towards alcoholism. But what did you do if you suspect you're a paedophile? At university in the 70s, I was elected president of the Students' Representative Council, at a time when in Glasgow University there was no counselling service. One day, a 20-year-old student came into my office and asked if he could speak to me. He first told me that he felt called by God to the priesthood, and then he said he wanted to admit to me that he had a sexual attraction to children. "Why are you telling me this?" I asked. "Because," he said, "I can't keep this secret any longer. It's too dangerous. I need to tell somebody, and I need to promise somebody that I will never, ever harm children." What would you have done? I never knew his name. Had he said he had committed an offence, my response would have been clear and straightforward, but this was different. He had somehow found the courage to admit to a potential he swore he would never pursue. Punishment after the event is not enough. Children will have been hurt. Yet we can't castrate or criminalise people who admit that there is within themselves a tendency they never wanted to be born with. Is it possible to affirm the potential for good that is in them while holding them accountable for ensuring that they are the only ones who will ever deal with the demons inside? Now, sometimes people write to Thought for the Day presenters, and not always politely. So I had one letter from an ardent Protestant who felt I had not done enough in putting the boot into the Catholic Church. But another letter came from a woman who accused me of being a rapist. Now, by the very nature of her incoherent letter, I presume that she has had a long history of abuse, which has left her severely psychologically scarred. There were also three letters, much more subdued in tone, which came from men, two of whom wrote with great appreciation that the issue had simply been aired. Both had similar stories. When they were in their early 20s, they recognised that they had a dangerous sexual attraction to young children. They knew that the criminality involved should they pursue their desires, and they knew intrinsically that this kind of activity was morally wrong in any circumstance. Both sought help, and both found help. And both went on to get married, have children, indeed one has grandchildren, and they have never engaged in any improper way sexually with children, their own or anyone else's. One, a man now in his 70s, said that the awareness of the desire had never left him, though its intensity had diminished with time. Both were examples of men who acted on their self-awareness and thereby prevented causing suffering to innocent children. But there was another letter from a man called, who we call Colin. He is, I subsequently discovered, now in his mid-30s. And he wrote from a prison in which he is serving a 10-year sentence for child abuse. His letter in some ways was the most moving because he did not for a moment want sympathy or try to rationalise his behaviour or even say that he was wrongly convicted. He said very clearly that his sentence was just and justifiable because what he had done to a child was despicable. But then he said that when he was a late teenager, he realised that he was sexually attracted to young children He tried to seek help, but he was never given any. I'll say that again. When he was a late teenager, he realized that he was sexually attracted to young children. He tried to seek help, but he was never given any. Now, gradually, I have begun to understand why he was never given any help. Because prior to the broadcast and after it, I spoke to a range of professional people to whom I asked the question, what would you do as a doctor, as a psychiatrist, as a social worker, what would you do if you were approached by someone who said, I want to talk to you because I know I am sexually attracted to children? This, as I said in Thought for the Day, was what I had been confronted with when I was student's president in Glasgow. I asked the question to a psychotherapist who said, I don't know what I would do. It has never happened to me. I only deal with people who have offended. I asked a doctor who gave a similar response. I spoke to a social worker and a school headmistress, both of whom said, I would report him. When asked to whom, they said the police. When I said, but what if he had never done anything? They were both stumped. They automatically presumed that admitting to the desire was proof of past guilt. I then spoke to an academic, a woman who I've known for a long time, a fond and trusted friend of mine, who had done extensive research on abused women. And after asking the question, there was almost 2 minutes of silence. And I realized what was happening, as has been the case with other people to whom I have spoken. The horror which the phenomenon evokes, especially if you've been abused or know people who have been abused, the horror is so intense that it is impossible to think with a calm mind about someone who has the potential, even if he or she has never exploited it. And we have a right to be horrified because the statistics are horrifying. It's now commonly reckoned that between 20 to 40% of children experience some form of sexual violence before the age of 18. More specifically, between 10 and 20% of all boys will, by the age of 18, have been the victims of sexual abuse or sexual menace. With girls, it's more horrific. Between a third and a half of girls will have experienced real or intended sexual violence before the age of 18. Between 80 and 95% of abuse is initiated by men. Over 75% of abusive acts will be perpetrated by relatives or authority figures, teachers, clergymen, in whom the victim has a measure of trust. And it's reckoned that the conviction rate for child abuse is 1%. But what for me is at least as horrifying is that virtually no one speaks of measures to prevent the potential offender from offending. And given the prevalence of this, why is nothing done to prevent people from initiating what will be damaging to children and damaging to them? All the eggs go in the basket of child protection and severe punishment for offenders. It strikes me as unusual that men can read in gents' toilets of how if they have XYZ symptoms, they might have gonorrhea, diabetes, or be alcoholic, for reasons of which they should telephone this or that helpline. Most people know that if they feel suicidal, they need only phone the telephone Samaritans, and thus will be able, in complete confidence, to speak to someone who may be able to prevent them from self-harming. But if you think you might abuse a child, where is the helpline to prevent such an eventuality? Instead, the demonization of abusers is so ferocious that people who realize they have this propensity to offend are scared out of their wits to seek help. They fear disclosure. And by keeping secret their desire, they become even more dangerous because the desire will intensify rather than abate. Now, if someone should be asking, but what has this to do with faith or with the church? I have to say it has everything to do with faith and the church. This is not simply because in the past 3 years there have been admissions of guilt and negligence on the part of the Roman Catholic Church in Northern Ireland, Southern Ireland, Boston, the USA. The Anglican, Mennonite, United Churches in Canada have admitted guilt, as have several denominations in Australia. But closer to home, it's important we deal with this because religion, even born-again religion, is no inoculation against this malign potential. And indeed, because the churches have been gloriously silent for centuries on this issue, potential offenders have found the church something of a safe place in which to indulge themselves. Over 20 years ago, the Orkney child abuse investigations brought the issue to national prominence. I was approached by a minister in Scotland and asked at that time if I might lead an evening service in which we would deal with something which was current in the news. Well, this was what the whole nation was talking about. So I decided to focus the attention of the congregation in prayers and scripture in common reflection on this issue. During the service, three women, a congregation of around 150, three women walked out. 2 weeks later, the minister phoned me to say that he'd been in touch with each one of these women. The reason for leaving was that each had been sexually abused by different men who were in the congregation that night. So let me do three things. First of all, I'll try to offer some perspectives on the phenomenon. Secondly, I'll ask why men especially engage in this. And thirdly, I'll ask how Christian faith responds to it. So here are perspectives which people may not have been aware of. And the first is that the reason why in Ireland and the USA and in Canada the church has been often named in association with failing to address child abuse, the reason is partly historical. In these countries, in the 19th and 20th century, there was not even the beginnings of a welfare state. The church built and ran schools, almost 95% of the schools in Southern Ireland. The church built hospitals and universities and teacher training colleges. The church organised poor relief and ran orphanages. It did what in Britain we regard now as the government's job. So where it was the sole provider of childcare, if a child abuse took place, it would, in terms of institutions, take place on church property. More particularly, with regard to the Roman Catholic Church, it's only in retrospect that the dangers of the preferred pathway to the priesthood, junior seminary, senior seminary, and ordination, only now have the dangers of this process been realised. In general, the removal of children from a family unit at the age of puberty meant that these fledgling priests, these boys who felt called to priesthood, were never exposed to regular family life as their secular peers were. Nor, with few exceptions, was there much reflection in seminaries about the implications of celibacy, what it would mean to decide for life never to have sex. The only thing that was talked about was the glorious sacrifice of giving up bodily desire for the living Christ. Over 20 years ago, two American authors, Burkett and Bruni, published a book called A Gospel of Shame, which looked carefully at Catholic priests and paedophilia. They interviewed counsellors of paedophilic priests and concluded that their actions did not happen as a result of young boys and girls being accessible to them. The priest's sexual attraction to children was present before ordination. It was their hope, I quote, that the mere act of ordination would trigger a mystical transformation that would lift their desires. But there's something more for which I have to acknowledge my indebtedness to a very weighty tome called The Puzzle by Louis A. Berman. Berman has produced this encyclopedic study of why people are homosexual, involving personal testimonies as well as published research. In his studies, he discovered that the Catholic Encyclopedia of 1967 gave two reasons why a devout homosexual should consider the priesthood as a career choice. Either to seek the help of grace to overcome his homosexual tendencies through a life of religious devotion, or B, to dedicate his life to a vocation of service to God and to men. I am not for a moment saying that every Catholic priest is a homosexual. I'm not for a moment saying that every homosexual priest is a paedophile. But if the issue of sexuality is never discussed with people who are taking a vow of celibacy, then to spiritualize it is to allow people the potential of becoming dangerous to children, to women, and to themselves. Secondly, until recently, children did not have a vocabulary which would enable them to speak easily about their body, and particularly about their genital regions. I think I was probably 12 before I realized I had a penis. That was not the name given to the thing which I regularly used. And children, particularly in church circles, were taught to respect adults, honouring the father and the mother. One victim, of whom I read, was taught in her Sunday school to honour her father, who hours before or after would be dishonouring her. But so strict was the code, and so silent were to be the children, that the abuse occurred, with no vocabulary about her private parts. What could that girl do? I realise now what happened almost 30 years ago, when an 18-year-old girl with very faltering vocabulary tried to explain something of herself to me which I could not understand. And now I realise that she had been abused, and I was blissfully ignorant at that time of the prevalence of that thing in religious circles. Third thing, which is a contextual thing, is that until comparatively recently, there has been no mandatory awareness training in state establishments as in the church. Little has been said in orphanages or to people who worked with children, even in the teaching profession, about what were boundaries. Childcare particularly was a job where there was little by way of vocational training of any kind until perhaps 25 years ago. And I know this because in the 1970s I worked for a London borough in a hostel for boys aged between 14 and 18. The boys were there. Some of them were there because they had been sent by the court. Some of them because their parents couldn't deal with them. Some because they were orphaned and were too old for children's homes. I was one of about eight staff, four of us being male, and the male staff had to get the boys out of their bed at 7:30. Not the most pleasant a task, adolescent boys, getting them out of their bed, downstairs for breakfast. And the guy who ran the hostel was a very rigid disciplinarian. So one morning I go up and I used to sing. I'd open the window, open the door, I'd sing and walk out. And they'd say, boys, it's time to get up. And I'd go back maybe 20 minutes later to ensure that they were out. And one of my colleagues would be doing the same in other rooms. So on my second round, to make sure they're up, I go into this room where there's a boy of 15 standing in front of a mirror, dressed but with an erection, which he's admiring in the mirror. And he turns to me and he says, what would you do with this, Mr. Bell? And I said, well, if I were you, I'd put it in your pocket and come down for breakfast. If I had been susceptible, if I had been susceptible to these words, which might have seemed like a come on, there would have been nothing in my training which made my conscience prick sufficiently to realize this was an overture for which there should be no response. More recently, I phoned one of my younger brothers who for 3 years worked not in an adolescent boys' home, but a children's home with boys and girls between the ages of 3 up to 12, 13. And I asked him whether he, in the late 70s, had ever had any awareness of proper conduct or boundaries in dealing with children. Nothing at all. So much of the abuse which is now being spoken of is that which happened 20 or 30 years ago, when it was a very different thing. This is not to make excuses, but to give a historical context. So now ask the second question. Why do men particularly engage in child abuse? I dearly wish that someone could give definitive information regarding this. I've read several books on the issue, but all deal with men after the event. No one seems to deal with the rogue element which is within certain men. From what I can glean, there are multiple factors. If you ask, are people born this way at the moment? From what I've read, I would have to say no. Or if they are, it's a very small percentage. Perhaps if it were a genetic disorder, more attention would be paid to those so affected. But so far, nothing in the DNA has been diagnosed. But there are other considerations. Many people, at their most generous, would say that those who abuse have themselves been abused. They feel they have been tainted, and either in an attempt to free themselves, they pass it on, as in a game of tig, or they've been so damaged by the abuse, they try to deal with that damage by inflicting a similar wound on someone else, taking revenge on an innocent victim. And certainly I remember, it'll be about 20 years now, being asked to speak to a young man in Glasgow who'd be about 28. I'll call him Tom. And this young guy had grown up in a house which was, in his childhood, 150 yards from where I now live. Between the ages of 10 and 13, he and his brother were sexually abused on a regular basis by his father and his uncle and his aunt, with someone else taking films which were sold to feed their drug habit. This guy, Tom, runs away from Glasgow when he's 15. He ends up in London. And eventually he settles with a girl and they become partnered. And they have a child, a girl. When she turns 10, he, haunted by this memory of his past, begins to feel tempted to abuse his daughter. Now, thank God he already was attending a psychiatrist. And therefore, he brought this issue out and it began to be dealt with. And in time, he and his partner separated and no abuse happened. But clearly, he was one of these people for whom abusing was a direct consequence of being abused himself. But not all victims become paedophiles. And not all paedophiles are previous victims. A social worker who specialises in this area, who I spoke to just last week, said that 95% of people who are sexually abused do not go on to abuse others. But certainly, according to another worker with abused children, if the normal process of sexual maturation is disrupted because of encounters at an age before the mind can understand what the body is doing, then for the rest of life, there seems to be a total lack of context or understanding what is proper behavior. If a girl is sexually abused before puberty, then the chances are that when she grows up, her understanding of boundaries with men or women, will be totally confused because she has not gone through that natural developmental process whereby, particularly at the onset of menstruation, there's a dawning awareness of what the body can magnificently do. But there are also people who have abused because of other demeaning childhood experiences, not necessarily sexual abuse. I spoke in the summer to a 37-year-old man in the USA who's attracted to boys. Whether or not he has abused any, he would not say, but he did admit to attraction. I asked him whether he was aware that to indulge himself would be both a moral and criminal act, and he admitted to being aware of that. And then I asked him, what was the root of his fascination with adolescent boys? And he began to talk about his childhood. He had never been abused, but he had been bullied by people his own age and a bit older, all through childhood into adolescence. He'd been very unhappy, and ever since he'd been distrustful of people older than him. He felt that he could connect more easily with adolescents who were younger and they with him. It was as if he were trying to relive years of his life, which were clouded with hurt and anxiety. But the sad thing is that this is a constant, and he only feels at home when he's in the company of adolescents. But let me read from a letter I received 2 weeks ago from the man who I mentioned at the beginning. His name is Colin. I'm calling him that. It's not his real name. And he's in prison. And I wrote to him because I knew I was going to speak here. And I asked him if he wouldn't mind answering some questions which might allow me to get that kind of insight that wasn't coming from elsewhere. And I said, I will never disclose who you are or the prison in which you are serving, but do be aware that I might quote from anything you say. So he sent back this long, detailed, and in a curious way, very tender letter, from which I quote, in response to your question about my attraction to children, let me give you some background. From a very early age, I experienced strong sexual feelings towards other children, mostly boys. These feelings manifested themselves in behavior from touching to more serious sexual acts. All this was between the ages of 4 and 12. When in secondary school, the dynamics of my relationships changed, perhaps the fear of being found out and being branded as gay or of being reported to my parents, the activity ceased. And this is how things were until my early 20s. I did not have a relationship with girls at school. I knew I was gay, but coming out was not an option. The school environment made me feel like a second-class person. I managed reasonably well in academic terms, yet I failed to mature as regards emotions, relationships, and boundaries. As my teenage years went by, I think I used recollections from my childhood as my sexual reference point. This is a rather long way round to say that there was no specific incident or point in time, but rather a failure to mature beyond the behaviour of my earliest years. However, there was a trigger in the mid-90s when thoughts were pushed into my mind via access to the internet. Although I did not seek out appropriate images, it was not long until I had found numerous places in which to find such pictures. Looking back now, I think that I often saw myself as the child in these images. I find this a frightening revelation. Maybe that is why I found myself seeking out older men for anonymous sex, sometimes quite violent, sometimes for money. James Newton Poling, an American pastoral theologian who has written on this issue, recognizes from his work with offenders certain common traits, though it seems to me that these may be the results of abuse rather than a pre-existing condition. He says that some of the reasons for this kind of behavior is A, a sexualization of dependency, a need to be needed, which leads to inappropriate intimate behavior. B, destructive aggression, a need to get frustration out of the system, and doing that by picking on a weaker being. C, a narcissistic disorder, believing that he or she is so perfect and important that every desire, either virtuous or base, should be fulfilled. And D, an inability to respect limits, which might be the result of being spoiled as a child by parents who refuse to say no. But along with this, there is undoubtedly something about men who are the vast majority, 80 to 95% of offenders. Polling and other people recognize that there are too many androcentered, male-centered structures which are presumptive of men rightfully being in power. The worlds of finance, business, industry, politics, and the church all witness to this. Remember how on the recent mission of the new government to India, the 60 glitterati who went to India included only 4 women. Now, India is not made up of a majority of men. The sexist presumption in popular advertisements that women are weaker, and the recurrent images in pornography suggesting that women need to be mastered, nourish the assumption that men have constantly to exercise power. Men have to prove that they are in control, and a frustrated man, a man who cannot speak of his distressed emotional state, or a man who is sexually frustrated, is less likely than a woman to talk about his dilemma with a friend. Instead, he may internalize it until the suppressed anger or frustration cries out for expiation and the victim becomes someone obviously weaker, a child or a woman. And the Jewish Christian tradition has played along with this for far too long. Male headship of the family has played into it. And there are stories within Scripture which to a fevered mind, might seem to give some encouragement to a potential abuser of women or of children. The story of Abraham, who loves both Ishmael, his son, to his concubine, and Isaac, his son, to his wife. Yet Abraham is prepared to see one of his sons starve and to sacrifice the other. The story of Lot, one of 2 stories, in which a man is prepared to send his daughters or other man's daughters into the streets to satisfy the lusts of a crowd of men who want to have sex with the angels who are in the house. The story of Jephthah, who because of a casual oath to God, sacrifices his daughter who has barely reached adolescence. And there is that theory of the atonement which sees God as an angry father who is so perturbed by the iniquity of his children that his anger will only be appeased if the son who is unblemished and sinless dies in place of the guilty. If these things seem far-fetched, then ask a Christian abuser about his theology. So how should we respond to this phenomenon? How do we deal with this rogue desire in a proportion of all people, believers and non-believers alike, to sexually engage with young children? I'm going to make some suggestions. These are not blueprints. These are not magic answers. But these are things we might ponder with each other, and these are some things on which we might ask. And the first is that we have to stop the sexualization of childhood. We have to stop the sexualization of childhood. 3 months ago, I found myself curious about two advertisements in Kelvin Grove Underground Station, which is nearest where I live in Glasgow. They were advertisements for clothing, for very stylish clothing. And the male and female figures who were modelling the clothes were standing in a fairly kind of provocative, look at me, come and get me position. And they were both androgynous. One was not clearly a male and the other was not clearly a female. And I looked at them several times before I realized what was so provocative about them. Neither of these models would have been any older than 9 years of age. And for people who had even a slight interest in children, these images would have been highly provocative. What I noticed was not atypical of a move within advertising to seduce parents into purchasing clothes for children which will make them look more grown up. And if they're made to look more grown up, then they might be made to act or to pose as if they're more grown up. And the process of sexualization, rather than a gradual dawning of hormonal change and emotional desire, is put out of kilter. I'm sure that no mother or father would consciously wish to make their child an object of desire for an adult predator. But if we insist on dressing them beyond their years, we steal childhood from them. Indeed, we may even be exploiting them. 2 weeks ago, I listened to women speaking about the lists of items on the market which were sold as must-haves for children, lip gloss for 5-year-olds, bras for 8-year-old girls who have no signs of breasts. They accorded with what Rachel Williams asked in a recent article in The Guardian. Why is our society grooming 3- and 4-year-olds to aspire to be a footballer's wife? Why is our society grooming 3- and 4-year-olds to aspire to be a footballer's wife? Secondly, I believe we can positively encourage an honouring of the body. We have to develop within children's work and youth work, in the churches as in schools, healthy ways of speaking of the body, and particularly in the church, healthy ways of giving thanks to God for the body. If we believe that bodies are important, if we believe that the dawning of gender and sexual awareness is a natural and good thing, if we believe that the body is the temple of the Holy Spirit, then why do we not speak of the body in our prayer life, in our songs, in our preaching? To tell children that they should avoid strangers is insufficient. We should also be able to give them such a sense of pride in their body that they will feel able to repudiate anyone who wishes to make a wrongful advance. In the city of Indianapolis, where I was working earlier in the year, I met this beautiful man. He was a professor of pediatric medicine, and he'd begun the Red Shoe Club, which was initiated by a wee girl of 8 years of age. And she had a terminal illness, which was fairly rare, so she was a bit of a medical curio. A wee girl who loved red shoes and who had a pair at her bedside. And one day, another eminent professor came in with students to have a look at this child because they might not see another one in their training. And they made their way round her bed and made to undress her. And she, the 8-year-old, says, you can't do this without my permission. So these men all went out. And the professor, who was not her pediatrician, came back in and apologized and asked her if he had her permission to undress her. And she said yes. And then the students came back in and they conducted the examination. And her pediatrician decided that there would be this red badge club, I suppose part in memory and in tribute to her, given to anyone in the hospital who does an act of kindness to a child. Children should be enabled to say no. Sadly, the previous Labour government had promised that sex education in schools would be so amended that from an early age, this would be one of the basic things taught. That's now been shelved by the new administration. But within youth work in our churches, particularly if we know that young people are going through adolescence, I wish now I had, when I was doing youth work, prayed with young people about the marvelous changes in their body, the marvelous dawning of new potential and desire and emotional upset and emotional attraction, and praying to God to be with them all through these changes and to keep them from harm. We have also to raise the profile of child abuse in public religious discourse, because the rate of the incidence of child abuse is so high, it's totally unhelpful if it remains an issue which churches only deal with when a priest is labelled a paedophile and some vicar or priest thinks there should be a sermon on the issue. It has to be the subject which is sensitively handled in prayer and in song as much as in speaking. We should be able from time to time to be specific in prayer, asking God's help for those who even years after deal with the memories that haunt their mind about abuse inflicted on them as children. And we should pray for those who in the present day feel tempted to abuse children, that they might seek help and never allow their rogue potential to harm others. If we can be specific about young men and women whose safety is at risk in Afghanistan, we can be specific about the far larger number of children whose safety might be compromised in their own home, where over 70% of abuse takes place. And if we don't allow these words to be heard in prayer, we are being complicit in allowing this thing to be kept under wraps. And we should provide safe havens. This is the most difficult thing, even to contemplate. Places where there are brave and compassionate people who will provide havens for those who have offended and for people who feel they have a potential to offend. Now, the latter, or rather the previous thing, for those who have offended, this happens in parts of the UK, particularly with Quakers. People who will befriend an offender when he, or in the rare case, she comes out of prison, enable them to live an accountable life, encourage them, enable them to experience a healthy family, and in some measure, to become reintegrated. I met a man in Canada 2 months ago who runs a group for sex offenders, which is now taking on the status, of a satellite church. He's a Mennonite, another peace tradition within Christendom. And he runs this group, which now includes elements of worship, because many of the men who come and who have been or who want to be people of faith are prohibited by the terms of their parole from entering churches. More difficult it would be to do the thing I mentioned earlier, to have a helpline or a helpful community which would deal in greatest confidence with people who knew they had a malign potential within them and wanted to prevent the harming of others and the dehumanizing of themselves. Just last week, I met a quite amazing Methodist pastor from America. Her name is Twiley, and she works in Texas, and she was visiting Scotland. Her church was confronted with the dilemma of having to decide what to do with a man in the congregation who'd been caught in a police sting. The police knew that he was looking at child pornography, and a policeman lured him into agreeing to meet what he believed was a 13-year-old girl. He was taken to court because he had committed no offence against the person. He couldn't be imprisoned, but he was put on probation. And the court made it clear that he could only go back to his church where there are children, if invited. So this pastor had to have discussions with her church leaders and with lay people, and be at meetings which were full of both passionate and compassionate speaking, after which the congregation together agreed to invite this man back. But to have him sign a covenant regarding his behaviour and to have him be befriended by some people with whom he will develop a relationship of trust, encouragement and accountability. Some people, very few according to Twiley, for personal reasons, said that if he came back, they perhaps would not be able to be in church. But she was amazed by the number of parents with children and the number of older people who were saying, this is a defining moment for us. If we believe we're a Christian community and God is impartial when it comes to hospitality, this is a defining moment for us, no matter how painful it is. One of the byproducts of their decision was the raising of consciousness on this issue, so that it became no longer something talked about secretly or behind closed doors or when there was a scandal, but people began to talk about child abuse and people began to say, you know, I was abused. And so now this church, with the help of a trained counsellor, has for its members and for the local community a support group for people who want to work through abuse which happened to them in their childhood. Here is a church which is seeking both to rehabilitate the offender and to care for the victim. What a risk. What a risk. The Thought for the Day broadcast, which elicited response from two men who knew themselves to be potential offenders, allowed me to make contact with possible violators who, thank God, would never have compromised the trust or defiled the body of a child. I remember thinking when I got these letters, wouldn't it be great if they were to speak out and say that preventative measures can work? And then I realized that that would be impossible, for no one in their family circle and none of their friends knows what they have lived with for 60 or 70 years. One of them said, you are only the second person in the world. You're only the second person in the world who has heard what I've had to deal with. The other person is dead. They cannot go public, nor can Colin, who is in prison, because when he sought help, there was no one there to give him it. It's for them that I've spoken.